Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and today on the show, we are listening back to the epic conversation I had with one of the funniest and most successful comedians of all time, Jim Gaffigan. I sat down with Jim face-to-face in the before times when he was just about to drop his 7th hour-long stand-up special, Quality Time, on Amazon Prime Video. Now you can hear his singular voice in Pixar's latest film, Luca, streaming this month on Disney+. We had a really wide-ranging conversation about his career specifically, but also about the comedy world more broadly. That is still one of my favorite episodes we have ever done on this show. So if you missed it the first time around or just want to hear it again, stay tuned. This is me with Jim Gaffigan.
Are you just out in L.A. doing press stuff, or what are
press
you...
Press for Them That Follow.
Yeah.
And then, back to doing shows.
Yeah.
I love it.
Are you doing stand-up?
Yeah.
While you're out here?
I don't know. I don't know how tired I'm going to be.
Yeah. How long are you out here for?
Well, I got in. I landed at like 10.
Oh, today?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Straight here.
They said you were going to be here, so I was like, I just got on a plane. I was in mid-meal,
yeah,
and I just ran to the airport. There was like, we can get a car, and I'm like, no, I want to run.
Yeah, I need
to
run.
I ran to the airport, and I was like, what's the next plane? And they're like, 13 hours. And I was like, that's inconvenient. So then I hung out for 13 hours, and then I got on the plane, and I landed, and I ran from LAX here.
That's a good long way.
It's just insane.
Like, you should have flown into Burbank, because we're in Burbank right now. That would have been more convenient.
Yeah.
But then you wouldn't have had such a long run and wouldn't have got as much exercise.
Workout. That's how I stay buff.
Yeah.
But what, Burbank, also, I travel a lot. Like, I don't want to one of those tiny planes. I don't want one of those planes.
No.
I want a fancy plane.
Yeah.
I was at the airport and someone stopped me and they're like, oh, my son's a big fan of yours. And we saw DJ Khaled. Or Khalid?
Is it DJ Khaled?
DJ Khaled was here too, and I was like, did you say we the best music? that's just what he does in his songs.
Yeah, he just says.
Produces it.
He says
right?
His name a lot. That yeah.
He's
but he's
like,
the producer, but
so he's like, you'll sing, then I'll say my name, and then I'll say it again.
Yeah,
I should probably say it at the end.
And it kind of interrupts the whole song
from my
perspective when he does that.
Like, yeah.
It's like really, he's producing a nice song and then he has to go shouting his name in the middle. And
it all started with Moby. Moby started it when he was dating Natalie Portman.
Oh, yeah.
That's when it started.
Very controversial.
That was very controversial. Canceling the book trip.
Yeah, Moby's in trouble.
Moby.
He's laying low.
He's going to disappear.
Was anyone? I think he's been laying low for quite a while, as far as I knew.
Did a huge album, disappeared.
Yeah, like 20 years ago.
By the way, I guess I can tell this story.
Yeah.
I used to do commercials for Rolling Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you remember, when you were a kid.
Yeah. I was drinking Rolling Rock when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It actually started as a non-alcoholic beer. But I did these commercials for Rolling Rock where I would improvise the commercials. And then Rolling Rock did this thing called the Rolling Rock Town Fair.
Hmm.
And they had a bunch of musicians in Latrobe, PA, where they start. And so like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Tool, all these people. And they're like, you're our spokesman. We want you to host the concert.
Hmm.
And so it was a pay-per-view. And so it back in that day, it was pre kind of this more sensitive era.
Mm-hmm.
But like essentially the pay-per-view camera would swing by and women would flash the camera. It was very
That's what people were paying for?
these were people in their 20s that were drunk at a concert. Anyway, so I'm hosting it. And, stand up and rock and roll go together great. And so, but it was fine. And then I introduced a band and I said, hey, I don't know what I exactly said. I think I said something like, you know, let's hear it for the women that are flashing. Their parents watching at home must be so proud. It was one of those things. And so then I introduced Moby.
Oh.
And Moby did like a 5-minute speech on how people shouldn't listen to me, that I'm a misogynist. And my girlfriend, who's now my wife, was there at the time. And I got off stage and I was like, and we were watching, and we were fans of Moby yeah. and Emoji.
Yeah.
And we were fans of Moby, and this was when Play was huge.
Yeah, he was like the biggest artist.
He was the biggest thing. And I was so shocked because I was like, was I sexist? Was I encouraging it? And she was like, no, you were making fun of them for doing that.
If anything, you were kind of discouraging it.
But they're just, you know, it's like, and so he went on to do like a 10-minute speech, which I had heard later on that he did at a lot of shows. And it was just so weird to be personally attacked. And I think, and so then afterwards, I was like, you know, I wasn't telling women to do that. And he goes, you know what you were doing. And I was like, so that's why I'm not a Moby fan.
Yeah.
That's why I'm on Star Wars Lady. I'm not good with names.
Natalie Portman.
I call her Nat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the Ports.
So you're on her. You're on team. Team Ports.
I'm on Team Ports.
Yeah.
I'm on Team Ports. But that's my only celebrity run-in. That's Moby. All I have. All right, we can wrap it up now.
Very self-righteous Moby behavior.
Yeah.
Well, enough about Moby.
Yeah.
Let's talk about you.
Okay.
You have a new special.
Yes.
Quality Time.
Yes.
It's on Amazon. That's very exciting. It's their first big stand-up special. Getting into the game.
I'm a pioneer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that part of the appeal to be kind of the first first big guy on Amazon?
It was, you know, comedians are, there's nothing normal about the behavior of a comedian, right? They go on stage and essentially attempt to seek approval of a room full of strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, they're in control. They have the microphone and they have material, but you don't know if it's going to work. So some of it is, I think, we seek kind of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was approached by Amazon, I was curious about it. I had kind of dabbled with the idea. I've done specials in different places.
You've kind of done them everywhere that you can do specials at this point.
Yeah. And so I viewed it as, you know, I have 5 specials on Netflix, and I had this other special that I released through this outlet called Comedy Dynamics, where it was essentially on pay-per-view and everywhere.
That was Noble Ape. That was the previous one, right?
And so there was a calculation. I mean, Amazon is the biggest thing in the world. So even if it was a disaster, it couldn't be that bad of a disaster.
Yeah.
Because I view specials, which is, this will be my 7th. It's, you know, some of it is I want people to be able to watch it and continue the conversation you have with the audience. And so I hope that people will go to Amazon to watch it. I don't know what the support from Amazon's necessarily going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I did things with Comedy Central or Netflix, I knew what the marketing was going to be.
Yeah, well, there was kind of a model for it. You knew what to expect, and this is pretty new. So, I mean, it's coming out. I mean, we're talking, it's coming out in a few weeks. I think when this airs, it'll already be out. So people can watch it right now, or maybe they already have.
Go to Amazon Prime right now.
But are you encouraged so far by what you've seen in terms of their willingness to promote it and get it out and let people know about it?
It's all new. You have to understand, and you know, you've been talking with comedians, and I think that there is, everyone's an expert on comedy, right? Because we all appreciate it on different levels. But how it's going to be promoted or advertised, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, look, Amazon is a monolith, so I assume that if they give it half the amount of attention that I would hope they would, it would be a pretty impressive marketing. But I don't know. So I guess it's like, I mean, I've been encouraged. I mean, it is, I mean, I would love, you know, I brought up ideas. I'm like, can you put on every Amazon box that comes out, can you put the name of my special, Quality Time. And they're like, no.
They're like, but it's quality products. Yeah. And I was going to tie in there.
They're like, we do that for our television shows. Yeah. So, but I don't know. But, you know, the deal is constructed where they have it exclusively for a year, mm-hmm. and then it reverts back to me. But I don't know. It's interesting with specials because they, you know, the world of how specials or our specials are consumed changes every 5 years. Mm-hmm. So when Beyond the Pale first aired on Comedy Central in 2006, that coincided when every college dorm room had Comedy Central on because mm-hmm. of the success of Chappelle and the success of The Daily Show.
Yeah.
And just now kids, college kids, there's no screen. They're on their own screens, mm-hmm. you know yeah. what I mean? Or other streaming things. And when I was in college in the 1800s, they had wooden TVs. No, so it's always changing. So I did a couple with Comedy Central. I did one on my own mm-hmm. where I had talked to Amazon about it and they weren't really kind of ready to go on board. So I did it on my website, similar to mm-hmm. Louis. And then I've done one exclusively with Netflix. And then but they've ended up with five of them. So yeah. then even with with Noble Ape, I was like, I want to make sure that it's not just for people that have Netflix, because mm-hmm. not everyone does have Netflix.
Yeah, it seems that way sometimes, but yeah. it's not necessarily the case. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed, I got to see the special and really enjoyed it. It does feel like, so the last special, Noble Ape, you were dealing with some heavy stuff in that special. Yeah. Your wife had a brain tumor.
Yes.
And was recovering from that, and you found ways to make that part of your comedy. This one does feel like a little bit of a return to some sillier material. Was that a relief for you to kind of, did you like doing that more serious kind of premises or how do you feel about it?
I think it's, you kind of write about what you're experiencing at mm-hmm. the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, life and death is pretty serious.
Yeah.
And so, everything compared to that is pretty light, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Appendix, 100 years ago, that used to kill people.
Yeah,
but
you had your appendix out. That's part of this one. Yeah.
I know. It's like, if you describe the topics of my set, I always get nervous because it sounds really boring. Mm-hmm. It's like, ooh, appendix.
Yeah.
Hey, oh, I can't wait to hear appendix material.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Horses. He's got 10 minutes on horses.
Yeah. People like horse jokes. They're really going to get excited about this one.
I don't even know why we have to specify that it's horseback riding. Other people are like, hey, you want to ride a horse? What part? The part that looks like a seat, the back. Oh, good, because I've done horse ass riding. That was painful. I kept falling off. I should probably tell you, the rest of the show is all horse jokes. Is he serious?
Some of it is, as a writer, you're, it's like what's presented to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you make it as, you kind of encounter the challenge that you deal with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the one thing I would say from an editing standpoint is I do intentionally limit the amount of parenting stuff I would ever put in a special. Because I remember being that comedian who was starting off being 25 and seeing comedians talk about their husbands or their wives or their kids
mm-hmm.
and thinking, I can't get a date. I don't know what this person's talking about.
Yeah. So you make an effort to make it appeal to a wider swath of people.
Or just, I would say that I make an effort to not focus solely on, I have five kids. I could talk about kids the entire time. Mm-hmm. But I do recognize that there's many people in the audience that don't have kids
mm-hmm.
or are kids.
Yeah, I mean, and your kids are not characters in your comedy the way some other comics do.
Yeah.
I mean, is that also a deliberate thing so that you're not kind of exposing them to that or that they allowing them some privacy?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's fascinating because we live in this age of exhibitionism and voyeurism,
mm-hmm.
right? And the comedy, when I started stand-up in the 90s, that's the 1890s, mm-hmm. when I started in the 90s, it wasn't necessary to be autobiographical. Like, if you look at Seinfeld in the 80s, mm-hmm. you never really learned anything about him.
Yeah.
And now, if you watch some comedians and they're not telling you a little bit, it seems almost odd in this day and age.
Yeah.
Because it's, we live in this reality show kind of, social media expose your beliefs kind of era.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to articulate, you have to reveal something about yourself. So I would say that when it comes to my children, like, I show pictures of my kids on social media, but I have friends that don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And some of why I don't refrain from showing them is because I'm too lazy. I mean, some yeah. of it is I'm not showing them in the most private, intimate moments.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when I wrote Dad is Fat, initially it was just a book about observations about being a dad. And then the editor was like, you have to be more personal. You have to be much more personal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned that opening up is how you can develop some intimacy with people. And so it's through Dad is Fat, and also kind of, you know, that's a certain vulnerability. That's why we respond to comedians, is that vulnerability. They're mm-hmm. they're exposing themselves and their flaws and mm-hmm. and their weaknesses and their insecurities. And I think that's what we all identify with.
Yeah. I'm interested in this idea, you know, you're saying that you want to appeal to the 25-year-old, you know, who knows nothing about being a parent and having a family, and sort of appealing to as wide a population as possible. And that must be true also in terms of demographically touring around the country. And you want to, you're a very famous, successful comedian who can play all over the country. How much does that go into your mind? Are there bits that you think of and you go, well, I don't know if that's going to play in this part of the country, or I don't know if this is going to play, whether it's political or just any or anything?
Well, it's very unique to each situation. What I would say on a, you also have to understand that there are people that are really good at certain things,
mm-hmm.
right? So there are great political comedians, and they should do that. And, you know, as a comedian does stand up, they learn, oh, you know, for some reason, when I talk about this, the audience responds differently than when my friend talks about this.
Mm-hmm.
So some of it, look, I'm a doughy white guy. So, like, I think when I talk about, or I learned when I talk about politics, it makes people uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It's also one of those things where I would say I'm very left-leaning, but I would also say I'm not, I have too much self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
So I change opinions on political things, not huge issues, but I would say I change my opinion, not on like Trump, but
yeah.
you know, like I would say that, you know, I love having discussions with people about it, but I'm also kind of always learning. So mm-hmm. I don't want to grab, some soapbox on a certain issue
mm-hmm.
if I, you know, there might be nuances to it. And I would say if you laid out a lot of my things, I'm very moderate. I'm socially liberal. You know, economically, I don't even know. I don't know. You know what I mean? I'm sure mm-hmm. I'd love for everyone to go to college, you know, and that the government pay for it. I'm for everyone having medical care. But some of it is on the political front. I remember touring during 2016, and my opening, my friend who opens for me is Ted Alexander, who's a great mm-hmm. comedian,
yeah.
who was like, he's pretty left. Like, he was Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah. And is that part of his act, or was it in
well,
that,
you know,
in
he's
that time,
also
yeah.
somebody who he can talk about it, and he can also not talk
mm-hmm.
about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he used to, during this presidential election year, he would do all these jokes on Trump and Hillary and Bernie and all this stuff. And it was so fascinating to witness the shift that occurred once the election happened.
Mm.
Once the election happened, Trump supporters were far more emboldened,
mm-hmm.
angry with And I, you know, like, I don't even have a Trump joke right now, but if I had a Trump joke, like, in the past year, I would get emails. People would be like, do not even mention the word Trump. Like, it is that powerful of a word. But even working around New York City, I find that when people talk about politics, there's a certain portion of the audience that looks at the ceiling. And that's not because they're conservative.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they don't care. It's an overall fatigue.
Yeah.
It's like, look, we sit at home and we watch Rachel every night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're coming here.
And they can watch Colbert if they want to. You know what I mean?
It's like,
yeah,
we're coming here to not hear about, not necessarily to not hear about it, but to, like, yeah, it's got to be better than Seth Meyers and Colbert.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know. It's interesting. Like, I turned down the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Oh, really?
The year Michelle did it. And it's like, you know,
that would have been very different.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's weird.
And Michelle Wolf, who was the, yeah.
It's, you know, there's also, in some ways, what else could you do? Like, I thought she did a great job. Mm-hmm. But, like, what else can you do? But we also live in this age where, I mean, I thought she was fine. I thought she was great. She was funny.
She did what she was supposed to do. Yeah.
You know, and I have a personal theory that there was obviously some sexism, but I think it was also unfamiliarity.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if Jeff Ross had been up there and done those same jokes,
yeah,
it wasn't just his gender. It's because he's known as the roast master, and he was known.
Yeah, people didn't know what to expect.
They didn't know Michelle. And so it was a status thing.
Mm-hmm.
And even when the journalists kind of, I was like, really?
Yeah.
It was pretty interesting.
Yeah, like Maggie Haberman and some of those people were piling on. Yeah. Why did you turn it down? Because you didn't think you could do those types of jokes? Or
do it. I mean, I guess I viewed it as, first of all, it's a bad room.
Yeah, notoriously.
It's not in my wheelhouse to just be a flamethrower.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love all my comedian brethren and sisters or whatever, but some of them are flamethrowers.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are the, you know, Stephen Colbert, you know, two feet from W saying that stuff. And some of us are, you know, that's like, I mean, I guess I come from a small town in the Midwest where I'm like, you know, even I want to be more like subtle. You know what I mean? And so, but I viewed the White House Correspondents' Dinner as, it was a no, I knew he wasn't going to go.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that there was going to be an onslaught of criticism no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do things in my career that will supposedly make me more famous. So it's like, I mean, that did make Michelle famous.
Oh, yeah.
But that's not what I'm going for anyway. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I want to continue to be a better comedian and an actor. That's what I care about. So, like, anything else that is, you know, that can kind of help your profile, I kind of repel from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I do want to ask a little bit about your wife, Jeannie, who, first of all, I mean, how's she doing? It's been a couple of years now since she had surgery, right?
She's doing well. She wrote a book that is coming out in October.
Oh, great.
And it's been this amazing, it's so funny because at one point she said, you know, I've been through so many things. And, you know, she's the mother of five. We've, you know, lost a baby, you know, and stuff like that. And she said, and she had a brain tumor. And she said, you know, doing this book is the hardest one because it is so taxing.
Yeah. It's about this experience.
It's about this experience. And it's about kind of her, you know, kind of reevaluating priorities. You can't go through something like that and without taking a look at how you do things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think human beings, we're idiots. So it's like we always have these moments where I held my newborn child and realized this is the priority. But then you're still going to be mad at the guy in on the highway for cutting you off 3 days later.
Yeah.
And so, but it's, so the book kind of looks at that and it talks about the journey and how she, you know, really found a lot of humor in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good book.
Yeah.
It's a good book. So,
I'm interested in how you were able to find humor in it. I got to see the, this documentary, it started as a joke, that's about the Eugene Merman Comedy Festival. And in that we see you trying out some material, I think early on about this. So it's interesting to see how it progressed from there. And so what was that like Do you remember sort of the first time you started talking about this on stage and how you went about it?
Well, this almost goes back to the exhibitionist and the voyeuristic thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was, because this stuff came down pretty quick. So Jeannie, had essentially some hearing loss, and she was sent to an ENT, and then as kind of a precautionary thing, they did an MRI, and they discovered this huge mass in her brain the size of a pear, which is why her book is called When Life Gives You Pears. And she, so it was one of those things where I was supposed to go to Austin and do shows, and literally, you know, like your life shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I learned by doing material was that we all have had those 2 weeks in a hospital with someone we cherish that is either gonna die or does die.
Mm-hmm.
And there's such a sobering kind of grounding that occurs that I think that we can't live in that reality. You know, like we all have that friend that's neurotic, that's always fearful of dying.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually normal. We're the weirdos that just kind of live in a certain
pretend
sense
that
of
that's
denial.
Not happening. Yeah,
and so it was strange to be thrust into that thing because, again, my wife is my writing partner, and we'd done the Jim Gaffigan show together where she was the showrunner, and it was a very kind of public our relationship. And then it was one of those things where this thing came down. And believe me, I'm very private. I know that sounds ridiculous saying that you're private when you're a comedian who goes on stage and talks about this stuff. But it felt very strange. I communicated to friends and family all the stuff that was going on. But then when Jeannie got out of it, she wanted to communicate to people what about the experience, that she was mm-hmm. okay. Because, of course, when you find out about a certain illness, the first thing you do is you Google about it.
Yeah.
And so you want to find people that lived, that didn't kind of like perish as a result of this. So she wanted, that was her first instinct, to get the news out there. And so I had some ideas, and she had brought up some ideas, and I was kind of I didn't know how it was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But I did know that at my shows that were coming up, the people that had gone to buy tickets to a theater, they probably knew that my wife had mm-hmm. been dealing with this.
It was in the news, and it was...
I had to address it. And then some of it is, I thought that like the best way to addressing that it was okay was, you know, you don't joke around about something that is still gravely an issue.
Mm.
I mean, obviously, sometimes you do.
Yeah.
But so that was one of the things. But it was kind of a slow build. But it was kind of fun and dangerous. But it also became very apparent that maybe somebody didn't have a wife with a brain tumor, but they had a grandmother who died of Alzheimer's, you mm-hmm. know, or something else. And so it was really amazing to see, particularly in this, you know, we're right at the divisive period, right, of that we live in right
mm-hmm.
now,
mm-hmm.
and to see how generous and kind everyone was.
Yeah.
There was, it was pretty powerful.
Yeah.
But of course, then, you know, 3 weeks later, I'm yelling at a cab driver. You know what I mean?
Do you remember the first thing that you were able to think was funny about it? Like, what was the first premise or?
Well, you know, for me, there are things that will come up and will just kind of, I don't know if the term is bump me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it probably was the description of the tumor as a pear.
Mm-hmm.
And then just finding it very odd that, like, we would describe tumors, you know, because I think my mother died from an ovarian cancer that was the size of a grapefruit.
Mm.
So, like, I had this memory of tumors being fruit.
Mm.
And so it just felt weird that how humans kind of process things, So that was one of those things that just bumped me, but it wasn't. It doesn't turn into a joke right away. It's just kind of something that ruminates a little bit, and mm-hmm. then eventually you kind of find some jokes behind it.
It was crazy. You know, the surgeon told me the tumor was the size of a pear, which is scary, but also confusing. I was like, did he go to med school or a farmer's market? But tumors are often compared to fruit. A pear, a lemon, a grapefruit. Interesting fact, worst tumor, grapefruit. Worst fruit, grapefruit. When you think about it, a grapefruit looks more like a tumor than a fruit. I almost feel sorry for grapefruit. Yeah, we can't win. Yeah? We're already the worst fruit. Now we're compared to the worst tumor. Well, at least we help old people poop. That is the worst impression of a grapefruit ever. It's kind of unfortunate that there's another fruit that's much smaller named grape. Because, you know, there's situations in doctor's offices, we found a tumor, it's the size of a grape. Thank God I didn't finish. Grapefruit. Oh, that's very different.
And then you're sitting in a hospital for 3 weeks. And, you know, it's like the people that work there, I don't know how they do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's the worst place.
Yeah. Right? I don't like hospitals either.
Right? I mean, but it's not as if people, you know, because people say that. They're like, yeah. I don't like hospitals. You're like, no one does.
Yeah, nobody does.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like there's a reason why doctors are paid millions of dollars.
Yeah, exactly. Do you feel like, was there, you said, you know, it was a good response from audiences. Do you feel like there was a disconnect for some people who maybe were coming to, you know, see the Hot Pockets guy and then were getting talked to about tumors? Was there any feeling of disconnect there?
No, it's, you know, some of it is the... I've been touring in theaters since 2006, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to understand is that the relationship that I have with the audience is, it's like a friendship. And so the thing you love about your friends is that they challenge you.
Mm.
And so there's, you know, there's the conversation, which stand-up is, that you have with an audience. Like, if I came back with only the same material, they would be very disappointed. Look, there might be, like, an 8-year-old boy in the room that just wants to hear Hot Pockets. But there's a lot of people that understand my sensibility. They understand my point of view. They understand that I'm a guy who struggles with laziness mm-hmm. and, you know, just likes to eat. And it's building off of that and challenging their preconceived notions. Because comedy is a lot of surprises. I remember sometimes Todd Glass will open and he'll be like, oh, you do these things to purify the audience. So, like, you'll bring things up to challenge them. And some of it, you do that with your friends. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? You want your friends to challenge you. You want your friends to go, you know what? That story's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And that's where I think it's, if you can make it interesting and entertaining. I'm not trying to present what I do as like brain surgery, but it has to be, there has to be some surprises. Like the relationship has to continue to be interesting.
Coming up, Jim reveals the origin of his inside voice, which allows him to critique his own stand-up performance while it's happening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Vanderpump Villa, a new reality show starring Lisa Vanderpump, now streaming only on Hulu. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabelle, a glamorous estate in the French countryside. Meet the elite staff as they work, live, and play together 24/7, while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. As they try to provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for their guests, the staff will need to meet Lisa's high standards. Not everybody has what it takes. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. If you're enjoying this episode, please hit subscribe. We have had so many incredible comedians on this show, including Sarah Silverman, Mike Birbiglia, Maria Bamford, Patton Oswalt, and so many others. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show or who you want to hear next. Now, back to the show.
I feel like you've kind of described yourself as a comedy nerd of sorts in past. Growing up in Indiana, what were your earliest comedy memories and references and people that you loved?
There wasn't much. I mean, as a teenager, I remember watching Letterman and
knowing he was from Indiana.
He was from Indiana, and he got out. Indiana is at the time. Because I think it's different now, but was a state with pretty low self-esteem. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, people would rather be from Chicago. They'd rather be from Cincinnati. And now Indiana has like its own, you know. But there was something about Letterman doing it. But like for me, comedy-wise, I think the influence was mostly, I'm the youngest of six kids, and I could kind of do an impression of my dad, and that would, you know, make my brothers and sisters kind of view me as some source of entertainment. But I remember watching, like, Phyllis Diller and, you know, Jonathan Winters and thinking they're amazing, and obviously Carol Burnett. But, you know, and then Seinfeld was a big influence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but Letterman, I liked the fact that he was kind of sarcastic, but in almost a certain polite way. It's weird because we've, you know, depending on how much you know about Letterman, Letterman was one of those guys who could make fun of you or make fun of someone, and they would be in on the joke.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very strange balance. I mean, he got angry at times,
but
he was definitely a grump like the last 5 years of his show. But it was a strange sensibility that also, you know, and I think Bill Murray was a big influence on me, like the kind of horsing around clownish guy it's a very accessible kind of silliness.
And then you ended up, you moved to New York and you started out in advertising, right?
Yes.
I actually started out in advertising after college as well before becoming a writer. So I know that world well. So what do you remember about the first time you got on stage to perform stand-up? Because it was kind of, the story goes that it was on a dare, or it was kind of from wanting to gain some more confidence in the advertising
meetings.
Yeah,
I was very insecure about public speaking. Like, I used to just blush. Like, even if I was in school and the teacher called on me, I would turn beet red. And so, in a business setting, it was pretty bad. And so, I did improv. I always had an interest in it. But the first time I did it, the first time I went on stage, it was like a revelation. It was something where I had these jokes, I had no problem, but it was the stage fright but it was so empowering. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was kind of an audience of bringers. They were very nice,
yeah.
But it felt like it worked. And I had spent my early 20s not knowing what I was supposed to do. I studied finance in college because essentially, you know, my siblings studied, like, you know, international terrorism, and they couldn't get a job. You know what I mean? So my dad was like, you can study finance or accounting. And so I hated it.
Yeah.
But I did it because that's what I was supposed to do. And so I finally found something that I was passionate about. And it was amazing because I also had an expectation that, like, there was no touring. I mean, there was, you know, like, Carlin was touring. That was it. And so there wasn't an expectation of making a living. It was just something about a level of fulfillment. And then I always had this romantic notion of being an actor and a general performer.
How early did the, you know, what you call the inside voice, which has become your your signature in a lot of ways, which is where you're commenting on what you're saying sort of from the audience's perspective, or I don't know how you would describe it, but how early did that come into it? Or do you remember the kind of first times that you tried
that? Well, that's something I would do as a teenager.
This guy's obsessed on food.
I am. I try to rationalize what I eat, but there's some food there's no reason to ever eat. Like a Cinnabon. I mean, tell me that place isn't run by Satan. You ever eat a Cinnabon? You have to take a nap halfway through. Oh, I think I need some insulin. And a wheelbarrow for my half a bun. It's kind of generous calling that a bun. It's the size of a beanbag chair. Should I sit in it or eat it? Hey, I could sit in it and eat it. Oh, this is sticky without pants on. He has his pants off in a lot of jokes.
I would do as a teenager to kind of alleviate tension among friends. Like if I was late to come over to someone's house, I would come over and start talking for them. And it communicates an awareness that you've done something wrong. You're articulating, you know, so you're articulating their complaints and taking ownership of it. So it was something that I did as a teenager, but I also, I think stand-up wise, I was a very, I mean, I'm probably a slower talker than I am right now in real life. And so when I would, when I started in the early 90s in New York City, I had to keep talking. So sometimes it was something that just kind of, it came out of this character. I used to do these characters at this place, Surf Reality, on the Lower East Side. And one of the characters would just talk for the audience. And I inserted it in stand-up a little bit, but it would be hit or miss. So it would either work really well or it would just be a tailspin.
They'd be like, what is
and
this guy doing?
So when I did my first, you know, when I did this Comedy Central Presents half hour, the inside voice had worked pretty consistently, but I was so scared it wasn't going to work that I didn't do it in that special.
Do you regret that decision? Do you think you should have done it then?
I don't know. I don't, you know, it's such a long journey.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's so many other things that I regret. There's times that I regret not just focusing on writing when, like, I think I would get so caught up in frustration. Like, I think of you know, like I started with Greg Giraldo and Bonnie McFarlane and all these people, and I was the last one to get a late night TV show appearance, and it really ate at me. And I look back now and I'm like, it didn't matter.
Yeah. What was your first late night? Was it on Letterman?
It was Letterman.
Yeah. So that must have been pretty meaningful when you got that. What do you remember about maybe how you got it and then what it was like to actually do it?
Oh, it was, well, I actually ended up getting Letterman and Conan the same night. Like, there was one audition at Gotham and one audition at Boston Comedy Club. And I obviously always wanted to do Letterman, but I...
And Conan was probably pretty new on the scene at that point.
Well, still, Conan was the cool kid on the block. And so I wanted to do both of them. But, like, doing Letterman, being from Indiana, you know, his influence on my sensibility was so pronounced and people would compare me. They're like, mm-hmm. you sound like David Letterman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did it. I think I was definitely ready sometimes. And it was a blur because I walked out. I did it. It was over. Then I walked backstage. My brother was there. And they came up to me and they're like, the executive producer, Rob Barnett, wants to talk to you. And I was like,
what did I do?
What did I do? And then I was like, but you know, it was probably something positive. Maybe he wants me to be a writer on the show.
Mm.
That's great. That's kind of what my initial goal was. And so then they were like, no, we want to develop this show. This, you know, they had just done Everybody Loves Raymond, mm-hmm. and this was going to be their next show. And
wow.
I was like, this is amazing. And of course, the show got canceled. But but it was it's interesting because it's one of those things where if I had gotten Letterman earlier, I probably wouldn't have been polished as I was in that
mm-hmm.
moment.
Mm-hmm.
And because Letterman developed that show with me, I think there were tons of people that took me more seriously as an actor. Because
mm-hmm.
also the entertainment industry is like, it's very much like Missouri. It's like, you got to show me. It's the show me state. It's like, you can tell someone you're good, but like in the end, no one wants to, and it's understandable. If you're a director or you're a producer, you don't want to take a gamble. There's too many moving parts to make a movie or a TV show work. So you want something that's going to work. You want someone who's going to show up and deliver and add value. And so I think that that show, which indirectly is because of Rob Barnett and David Letterman, is which is directly because of them, is why I slowly got this film and television acting career.
Yeah, I mean, your film career is definitely taking off this year. You have 7 films coming out this year.
It's amazing. That was the point. But I would love to have like had those 7 films dispersed over like the last 7 years.
You didn't
years.
Really want them all to come out in
yeah,
1 year.
They didn't all have to happen the same year. But it is so fun because I do enjoy acting so much and playing these different characters. It is so, like, the thing I'm most excited about is that directors and producers will see me in something and go, okay, that guy can act.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what I'm most excited about.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you have no control over whether the movie works, it gets well reviewed. It's just all, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's so many moving parts.
Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, I've been kicking around for so long. I just want the opportunity to work on good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of, you know, being known for kind of sillier material maybe early on, some of these movies are super dark.
Yes.
I got to see Them That Follow at South by Southwest and really enjoyed that. You play opposite Olivia Colman.
Yes.
You play husband and wife. That's pretty cool.
And she's her career's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. She won an Oscar sometime in between shooting that film, I think, and now.
And then she'll be in the Crown coming up.
Yeah. So that one, and then American Dreamer.
Yes. Did
you see
that one?
Even more dark. Yeah, I just got to see that, and that kind of fucked me up a little bit.
Yeah. No, I love that one. That one, I mean, I love Them That Follow. The weird thing is like, comedians were so spoiled in a way because we go on stage. You're the writer, performer, director. You do it all. And I love acting. I love being a participant and being a tool to tell a story or even communicate a moment of emotion. But you can't have control
mm-hmm.
over everything. So in Them That Follow, I mean, I loved, and there's such amazing actors on that. But like, there is something I'm like, I wish you would have cut this a little differently. And that's selfishly because, again, I want directors and producers to see that and go,
mm-hmm.
that guy's a good actor. I'm going to hire him because mm-hmm. no one wants to take risks.
Yeah, yeah. Going back to stand-up comedy for a minute, are you a fan now of stand-up comedy? Do you like watching other comedians' specials, or do you try to keep up on that stuff, or do you kind of try to stay in your own world?
You know, it's
in your
interesting because there's, you know, some of it is, I would say that I love stand-up comedy. I don't watch general comedies.
Mm.
Like, I'm sure The Good Place is great. I'm sure Parks and Recreation was great. Didn't watch any of them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather watch a drama. But stand-up, I will watch because I appreciate the craft.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's someone where I don't like jibe with their point of view, I can appreciate the craft of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, oh, that's a great story, but, you know. But some of it's authenticity.
Yeah.
So, like, my whole thing is I get caught up in, like, is it true? So, like, you can, obviously, there's some lying that occurs.
Mm. And in your new special, you admit that you lie from time to time.
Well, that's also kind of this ongoing thing. Like, and it's kind of a pet peeve of mine. It's like when people say, I never lie up there. I'm like, you're lying. Mm-hmm. You're lying there.
Yeah.
And so it kind of started out of that.
Yeah.
And by the way, there are comedians that make a strong effort to make their stories as realistic as possible. Mm-hmm. But there's still some artistic license.
Yeah, there has to be.
You know what I mean? To make it interesting and compelling. Mm-hmm. And so, but like if I watch something and it's a lot of lies, it's like, now my girlfriend's doing this. I'm like, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm out. And by the way, I think that's a reflection of this voyeuristic exhibitionist mm-hmm. time that we live in. I think in the 90s, you could lie.
Mm-hmm.
But now there has to be a certain authenticity to behind it. It has to be grounded in some realism.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, so yeah, I could know a guy like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, and again, it's like you can do it here and there, but if it's all lies from wall to wall,
mm-hmm.
I think that then I just check out.
Yeah. I was curious if you got to see Aziz Ansari's new Netflix special.
I saw some of it.
Yeah,
I saw some of it.
I mean, talk about sort of serious confessional stuff. I mean, he's getting real. He got pretty real in that.
And I always think about a conversation I had with one of my friends where he was like, you know what, man? That whole thing made me think about every date I've ever been on. And I thought, wow, well, that's pretty incredible. This made not just me, but other people be more thoughtful, then that's a good thing. And that's how I feel about it. And I know this isn't the most hilarious way to begin a comedy show. But it's important to me that you know how I feel about that whole thing before we share this night together.
Aziz, you know, it's so interesting because there's part of me that's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I, you know, like, and as a comedian, all I want is another comedian to be able to do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's like Marlo and I was giving Marlo so much shit.
From Daily Beast,
About how, like, the media is at the time, the media was addicted to Louis stories.
Mm-hmm.
That's not taking, and so funny, I got so much. So Marlo did the article, and I go, I'm going to get criticism because I'm not attacking him.
Yeah.
And he goes, why? You're making a point that, like, the media is talking. And I did get criticism.
Yeah.
Well, but so, like, the Aziz thing, it's like, it's so complex because I have no other reason than to believe him.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, there's something about the confessional style that the sincerity. It's weird. It's like, I'm also a believer, and this is not a comment on his special, but, you know, I am like a child of Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't want me describing it like that. But every sincere moment in a special is a time you could have been funny.
Yeah.
Like I'm not talking about like a sitcom where there's a laugh every 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about like when people do sincere things, and obviously Aziz had to address it, so I'm not criticizing him. I'm talking about like generally overall when people do things that I think are, you know, emotionally manipulative rather than funny, it seems wrong to me. Like I think it should be funny. And you can do both.
Well, even on Seinfeld, the sitcom is famous for, you know, the no hugging, there was never a sentimental moment in that show.
And by the way, I think also we live in an age where, you know, going back to like vulnerability is what people like. But I think that I'm trying to think of like, because I was talking to Seinfeld about this. It's like there's moments, and I was describing a moment, and he goes, that was time that could have been funny. But you know why they didn't? Because being funny is harder than that.
Mm.
So being vulnerable, I think it's an important element of comedy, but comedy's still harder.
Yeah. There has to be a funny payoff to the sentimental moment.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think Aziz, there are definitely moments in that special that don't end on a joke. you know, where it's just pure, and it, and I think it is probably because he felt like he had to be sincere almost, with his
audience. Yeah, I mean, he's
audience
lived with it. It's like, you know, and he's also toured with it, so maybe he has to do it like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
So it's, we live in this age where, you know, again, here I am, a straight white male. You know, it's like, this is where I shut up and listen.
Yeah. Yeah.
See what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think the flip side of the Aziz thing is, and I haven't seen Louis perform, but from everything I've read and heard, that he has not been willing to kind of address it in a, even in any real way, whether it's serious or comedic or anything, that he's kind of made some throwaway jokes about his own situation, yeah. And maybe that's preventing him from having the same kind of comeback that, that Aziz had.
It's such an interesting time because it really... It divides, there's this divide in the comedy community. And by the way, what I love about comedians is that you can have a different opinion. There isn't the divorce that I believe is happening in our society. Mm-hmm. Like I have friends that are libertarian and I have friends that are all these different kind of things. And because like if you can watch a comedian, if you can be friends with someone and not like their act,
mm-hmm.
you can be friends with them and not like their opinion on something.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can argue with them and, you know, like they can be a crazy right winger or a crazy left winger. And in the end, you have this kinship of comedy. And also, you know, comedians, I think we all know that comedians all know that we're crazy. You know what I mean? It's like, there's a possibility some of us are going to be in the loony bin.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, I don't know. That's yeah. what I love yeah. the difference of opinion.
Yeah.
So
and being a comedian trumps all the other differences that, you know, being
I
comedians,
think so.
Yeah, that's your community.
Yeah, it's like, look, I don't work in props, but, you know, if Carrot Top needed my help, I'd love to help him. Do you yeah. know what I mean? Because he's a comedian.
He's in the tribe, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, he's eaten unknown amounts of shit for no reason at all.
Yeah.
For being successful,
mm-hmm.
for being popular.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's why I'm running for president.
So before as we start to wrap up, what I like to do at the end of the show is run through some things that we didn't get to talk about.
Sure.
And just if you can pull out one story or memory or something from it that comes to mind when I mention it.
Sure.
So one of your early jobs was working on the Ellen show with Ellen DeGeneres.
Yes.
So what do you remember from that time?
I remember Martin Mull being like the nicest man
mm-hmm.
in the world. It was a very interesting time period because Ellen, who we know as kind of, and I mean this only as a compliment, the gay Thomas Jefferson for mm-hmm. the entertainment mm-hmm. industry, was going through this breakup with Anne Heche,
mm-hmm.
Where the breakup was over, and then she was doing this sitcom. It's like, you have to understand, in the next studio was Will and Grace. Like, we've changed so much. Like, my 15-year-old daughter, like, had a multicolor gay flag birthday cake
mm-hmm.
because she loves everything about mm-hmm. gay community. But Will and Grace was very dangerous, and Ellen was this exception.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that it was a really interesting time period because she was under an enormous amount of stress. But I'll always remember that, you know, Carrie Kenney was great, and Martin Mull, one of the sweetest guys.
Mm. Another early role was Sex in the City. You played a character who dates Miranda, Cynthia
yes.
Nixon's character.
Yes.
So what do you remember from that experience?
I was like, this woman's going to run for governor one day. No, what I remember is that in that episode, I went to the bathroom with the door open. I was known as the open door dumper.
The next morning, Miranda got up early to pee in peace and make Doug coffee.
Hey, smells great.
It's the cinnamon I add to the...
Apparently, when Miranda left the door open for peeing, she opened the door for everything else.
You know, sometimes I like to add a pinch of nutmeg to my coffee. That takes a lot of the...
Maybe it was narrow-minded, but for Miranda, an open door dump was definitely worth dumping someone over.
And I had to audition. And so I was like, I don't know how I'm supposed to audition for this. And they're like, well, just, I mean, they wanted to see that I wasn't acting. You know what I mean? That I was kind of living real in the moment. But that was, there was, for many years, that was the thing I was known for. The open door dumping, the meow guy from Super Troopers, and the manatee joke that I had. And so when the Hot Pocket joke took off, I was like, this, you know, the manatee joke was a thing. This Hot Pocket thing is going to go away. And it never went away.
Yeah. I know you like to tell that story about how you're the CNN label with the Hot Pocket, Jim Hot Pocket Gaffigan.
Yeah. Brutal.
Did that make you hesitant to go back on cable news after that?
Well, no, it was so ironic because I think I was, because I had released my special and a dollar from every $5 had helped wounded veterans. So I was there. It was like, I think it was Memorial Day weekend. It was like all well-intended and talking about how veterans should get more support. And it was just someone, I think Henry Phillips tweeted me the photo and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. But there's something about comedians, people just think we're clowns. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, that's all he wants to be known as, the Hot Pocket guy. You're like, all right.
You've also you've made a couple of appearances on Fox News over the years. I was curious if you had any stories about that.
Well, that was really this is also, it's so weird because now it's I've turned down many appearances there, but there, believe it or not, before I would say, Bill O'Reilly, it's so funny because Bill O'Reilly lost his job while my wife was essentially in pneumonia, and almost dying. And so when she kind of came out of it, I was like, she couldn't talk. I said, Bill O'Reilly's gone. Like I was giving her, I mean, that wasn't the first thing. Yeah. That wasn't like, hey, you're back.
Her eyes open.
No, it was like I'd gone through a bunch of kids stuff, and then we were talking about other stuff. And you have to understand, she couldn't talk, and my wife is a talker. I'm the quiet one, and she was very frustrated. She couldn't eat. She couldn't eat for regular food for a month and a half, maybe longer. I don't know. I'm sure I got that wrong.
Yeah. Good thing that wasn't you. Yeah. Be bad.
Oh my God. But then she had to be married to the biggest glutton in the world. And so anyway, so we'd gone through and I was giving her an update on the kids and I said, oh, by the way, Bill O'Reilly got fired. And she wrote on a piece of, she was frustrated. And she was like in pain. She's like, I don't give a fuck about Bill O'Reilly. And I was like, yeah, good point. But anyway, to answer your question, what you have to understand is that Dad is Fat, Food of Love Story.
These are your two books. Yeah.
In the book world, there, and it's shifting. Mm-hmm. It's always shifting. Mm-hmm. And my wife, again, has this book coming out in October. So what it used to be Oprah, right? Oprah, you go on Oprah.
I think it's The View now is the big one.
You know what's weird? Is like, I had heard that for a while it was Wendy Williams.
Oh.
And so it might be The View.
Yeah.
And so you do all these things and then they're like, hey, I think it was Dad is Fat, Father's Day weekend. It had been like 17 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. They're like, we think if you go on Bill O'Reilly, you're going to be number one. And I'm like, I'm not going to be, they're just publishers trying to get it. And I was like, I think I had seen other comedians. They told me other authors that had done it. And I was like, all right, I'll do it. And it was very strange because it was one of those things where I didn't want to get political. I didn't want to, I didn't want to get, I just wanted to plug my book and get out.
Yeah.
And so I did it, and I did it on like a satellite feed. And by the way, I had done a corporate event, and he was there. You know, Bill O'Reilly is probably 6'4", 6'5".
Yeah, he's a big guy,
He's a big guy. And this is before the him paying off women and $20 million. But he was still like considered
generally loathsome.
Right. But so I think, so I did that. I think I did Bill O'Reilly twice. And then, my friend, by the way, so Ted Alexandro opens for me now. And then before that, my friend Tom Shalhoub opened for me, who is now, he then took over for Red Eye.
Fox News guy,
And so like, but like, and I love Tom. Mm-hmm. I love him. And again, like, I don't necessarily have to agree with him, but it shows you that, like, comedians, you know, I mean, it was, you know, it's also, I think you have to, like, understand that, you know, the view of Fox News might have been, it was different in the pre-Trump era.
Yeah.
It was much more of, but, you know, I had never, even back then, I'd been very selective.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was it like when you did it with him?
With Shalhoub?
No, with Bill O'Reilly. What was it like when
you
were on with
them? It was very awkward. It was very awkward. They did a pre-interview. They wanted to ask me political questions. I'm like, I don't want to ask that. And then Bill O'Reilly asked me completely different questions.
Of course, yeah.
It's interesting because there is, because Dad is Fat is essentially about how this comedian never thought he'd be a father, ended up being the father of five kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, some of it's constructed on the belief that I don't know what I'm doing. And so that is, and he goes, so this book's all about how you don't know what you're doing. So it ended up where it was a very strange thing. And he's like, I don't know. I like what I'm doing. So it ended up working because it was, he kind of attacked me in a strange way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, so I did that. And then I think I might have done Food, a Love Story. But like there was another time I was on Bill O'Reilly, but I wasn't on the show. But someone had sent me the clip where he used to do like odd news stories.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you know, and one of them was Billboard released the top 100 touring acts in America. And this is when I first started touring, doing stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just barely, I'd maybe done like theaters in like 10 cities. So I was like 99, which I don't, you know, is still kind of impressive. But like Bill O'Reilly is like, and he's like at the bottom. So like the top of the list was Beyonce and U2. And he goes, and then at the bottom of the list, I don't know, some of these people, they got to really get their act together. And so it was like, you know, Hootie and the Blowfish or whatever, and me, and I hadn't been on his show, and he goes, this guy, Jim Gaffigan, I don't know what he does, but he's not doing well. So it's like, you have to understand, it's like, even describing it, it almost sounds almost enjoyable.
Yeah.
Compared to the world we live in. Yeah. Right?
It's a
when he's just
time,
like, you know, I don't know, Gaffigan with his, I don't know what he's doing. Like, he thought it was probably a,
and then
a singer.
He was going to cameo on the Jim Gaffigan show,
yes.
Right? And
yes.
And he canceled? Or he wasn't allowed to? Or what was the story?
I don't think anyone on Fox was allowed to.
Yeah.
Because in that episode, which was all about us, you know, the tabloid nature of our culture, and he didn't do it. I don't think anyone at Fox could do it.
Yeah.
I think we got Glenn back, like conservative, but like we got Rachel, we got like Nancy Grace, we got Don Lemon.
Yeah.
But I don't think we could get any of the Fox News people because it was all about how, I don't know if you saw the episode.
Yeah, yeah.
It was
a great
all,
episode.
I mean, I loved how it was just like, it starts off one way and then it just spins and spins before you know it.
I thought that episode, so the episode of the Jim Gaffigan show where you, or there's a picture of you holding a Bible and then it becomes controversial.
Yeah.
I thought it was so fascinating too because it was this like window into a you haven't had a ton of controversy in your in your career. So this was kind of like what your controversy would be.
Well, it's also, it was a little bit of a commentary on being Catholic. And how among, you know, like, I mean, I wasn't Catholic for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met my wife and like I lived across from a Catholic church and I never went in there. I was like, I'm not doing that. And so then she brainwashed me. No. Yeah. So then I ended up going in there. But like among comedians, which have kind of a general kind of overriding dose of cynicism, it's very peculiar. So it was kind of playing off of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you about is opening for the Pope in 2015, which was a big, big moment in your career. I think you're still the only comic to open for the Pope.
Yeah. I mean, there might have been someone. Someone sent me there might have been somebody in San Francisco that opened for a Pope that visited in San Francisco. But
so now it's been a few years since that. When you look back on that, what stands out?
I mean, it is such a absurd. See, look, I don't view that whole experience as the most difficult thing was not opening for the Pope, the most difficult thing was doing a show outside in Philadelphia, which is just absurd. And I love Philadelphia, and I've gone back numerous times. But some of it is also, you know, we all have these moments where we talk to someone and we say the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, why would, and you think back later on and you're like, why would I say that? That's so stupid. So I know what Philly's like. I know that, like, they're, you know, and I'd known that they were sensitive about this Santa Claus thing with, you know, supposedly at an Eagles game, they, you know, people threw snowballs at Santa Claus. And they were just done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I was backstage and I was thinking of jokes. And I was like, you know what, maybe I'll do this and that. And it just backfired. And so it was this incredible experience. And it is, I think it's a noble ape. I end the special talking about it. But, you know, the whole Pope thing, it's fascinating. I got my mother-in-law to meet the Pope. So it's like,
what more can you do?
Right? It's like slam dunk. Best son-in-law ever.
So we end every show by asking comedians what the last thing that made you laugh really hard is. I know you said you don't love watching traditional comedy. So what does make you laugh?
There's been some moments in Succession that made me laugh.
Yeah. Anything that stands out that you can remember?
The guy who is now married to Shiv.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tom.
He is really funny.
Yeah, that guy's hilarious.
And, like, I think at his bachelor, because it's also the combination of him talking to that guy who's, like, in a, like 21.
Yeah, Greg. Tom and Greg are
It's
the,
like
yeah.
those two conversing mm-hmm. is just, like, I laughed out loud a couple times. Mm-hmm. You know, just like him, like, that guy is just so funny because he has this uncanny ability of like being vulnerable but also being bombastic and arrogant. It's yeah. something that, and then he'll say something and then his eyes will just communicate absolute defeat. And so it's just so funny.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I love Brian Cox. I was in that championship season with him on Broadway. So
Yeah, that show's nominated for Succession's nominated for Best Drama at the Emmys, which I think is odd because it's one of the funniest shows
it's
on TV.
It's a really interesting.
But it's an hour, so I guess that makes it a drama.
It's like so dark.
Yeah.
Some of like just like there's the stuff that stays with you where you're like, "Oh no." Oh no. Like when he had the Chappaquiddick moment.
Yeah.
And he goes
that
back.
That does get dark.
And then everything's fine. And then the dad's like, you're going to do this. And he's just like, yeah, okay. It's just it's the biggest
sad.
Setup and punchline.
Yeah.
It's the whole episode.
Yeah. Ugh.
And you're like, that is hysterical. It's so dark. Because the one thing that could happen to make the son kind of back down.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, there's... Yeah. Nothing to think about.
All right, Jim. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It was
Appreciate
great to talk
it.
To you.
Thank you.
Thank you again to Jim Gaffigan for coming on The Last Laugh. You can hear his voice along with Maya Rudolph in Pixar's Luca, available to stream on Disney Plus starting June 18th. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.